Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. That Day May Face the Rising Sun is being rightly lauded and being called the best Irish movie of the year. And I speak to its director, the legendary Pat Collins. We review the week's other new movie releases, including Challengers, where Zendaya plays a tennis coach with a past. And In the Land of Saints and Sinners, where Liam Neeson plays a hitman coming out of retirement. Plus, comedian Anne Gildee chats about her favourite film. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well and you had a good week. I had a good week. Regular listeners will know that I am a big Everton fan. And look, we just had a magical night Wednesday evening. Now, I have a lot of friends who are Liverpool fans, so they've been bleeding red this week. So I have to mention it is all, you know, but we won't say any more than that. Other than, you know, in movie related news, I spoke to Jared Harris about 8 weeks ago, I think it was. And he is mad, or a big, maybe he's mad as well, but a Manchester United fan. And we were talking football afterwards and he said to me, it's over. As soon as you lose a match and you're heartbroken, you just have to move on. So I'm giving my Liverpool friends advice via Jared Harris in a very Screen Time-like fashion, if I may be so bold. But anyway, we're all in it together or something like that. Let's move on. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
I would like to report something. How does it work?
What would you like to report?
I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm getting stalked.
By a man or a woman?
A woman.
And have you had a sexual relationship with this woman?
No, I haven't. She's a bit older than me.
Age is generally not a factor we consider.
Of course, I can assure you, though, I absolutely haven't.
Okay, look. You say this woman's stalking you?
Yeah, she comes to my work, she comes to my house. She sends me emails, like all the time. I'm really worried here. I think she needs help.
How long has it been going on for?
I don't know, like 6 months, maybe.
6 months? Why'd it take you so long to report it?
Now, that is the show that everybody is talking about. That's Baby Reindeer on Netflix. And you heard there, the writer, producer and star of it, Richard Gadd. This is being talked about for all sorts of reasons. In it, Richard Gadd plays a kind of want-to-be stand-up comedian who is being stalked by a woman who just comes into the bar he's working in, Martha, played by Jessica Gunning. And she enters his life and refuses to leave. And as you heard there, sends him literally hundreds to thousands of emails during a week. Then something pretty horrific is revealed about Richard Gadd's life, something that happened to him of a sexual assault later. And I won't say much more than that because that's not revealed for a while. And I think you should watch this, or certainly if you do want to watch it, don't read too much about it because you'll see what happens. This is based on Richard Gadd's events in his life. And he turned this into a show in Edinburgh and Netflix got in touch with him. And it's a comedy, and yet it's incredibly dark at times. Richard Gadd has come out this week and said, please stop amateur sleuthing this, because some of the horrific things that happened to him, people could attempt to start trying to figure out who were his stalkers and indeed, in one case, his abuser. And he's asked people not to do that. So this is quite controversial for various reasons. It is a compelling watch, I have to say. I knew very little about it going into it, and it really held my attention. It's weird in the way that it is a comedy a lot of the time, and then at other stages, it is so not a comedy. It's 8 episodes. It is unusually compelling. So I would tell people to watch it. It is very hard going at times. You know, you could make the claim that is this a bit tawdry at times, but this is one man's story and it's his story to tell and he's telling it, and that is Richard Gadd. So I think this is fine TV. May not be for everyone because it's a tough watch at times. It's also very funny at times. So if you don't like the harshness of life, and a lot of people don't want to see that when they watch TV, well, don't watch this. But if you're okay with that and you want a compelling comedy drama, by golly, Baby Reindeer is certainly that. And now we turn to the week's new movie releases. And this week we're looking at Challengers, a tennis love triangle from somewhat, I would have thought, unusually, Luca Guadagnino, and a new Netflix Northern Ireland thriller called The Land of Saints and Sinners with Liam Neeson, which is on Netflix. Delighted to be joined now by regular movie reviewer on this show, arts critic and film journalist or film critic or film something something, Chris Wasser. Hello, Chris.
John, how are you?
Good. I've seen one of these movies. Let's start with the one I haven't seen because it's the big cinema. Well, one of the big cinema releases of the week, because I'm also pointing out that They May Face the Rising Sun is a big cinema release as well. But Challengers, as I said in the intro, you know, people will know Luca Guadagnino from things like Call Me By Your Name, an Italian director. When I read that it was him behind this, I thought that's unusual maybe, but maybe it isn't.
Yeah, he's difficult to pigeonhole. I'm a big fan of his films. I was talking to someone about this recently. I'm a big fan of Luca Guadagnino's brand of trash, because, you know, when he makes films like Challengers or A Bigger Splash, you know, some audiences might come away and they'll say, oh, it's all very soapy and it's all very over the top, or the soundtrack is too intrusive. And it's like, well, that's kind of Luca all over. It's always more. And Call Me By Your Name was probably one of his... it's probably one of his films where he kind of held himself back a little bit, and he just allowed the story to take center stage, and he allowed the actors to just do their thing, and it's a very natural setup. But I am a fan of his work. Even that Suspiria remake he did, John, that was so odd and a little bit unnecessary, but there were things about it that I liked. And I was well on board. I was well on board with Bones and all, his cannibal love story with Timothy Chalamet. It's probably one of the best films I've watched that I never want to see again. So in short, Luca Guadagnino is all right. You know, he's okay by me.
Yes, it clearly sounds that way. I was saying to you before we came on air, Call Me By Your Name, not that it left me cold. I thought it was a good movie. I didn't quite get why people loved it as much as they did. But listen, let's get to Challengers, because we could go down that particular rabbit hole. Zendaya plays a tennis champion who's cut down in the prime of her life and becomes a pretty steely-nosed tennis coach, is my understanding.
Yeah, so Zendaya is Tashi Duncan, and she is the hard-nosed coach of the tale, but she should have been the contender. She should have been a champion. And this film takes us through around a decade and a half in the lives of its characters, who are all at one stage romantically involved. And yes, she is, you know, she has her whole future set out for her, and we see her as a teenager. She's a brand ambassador already for Adidas. She's winning all of these trophies. She actually decides to go off and study at university and to kind of, you know, prepare a life. You know, she knows that she's going to be a tennis player, but she wants to prepare something for when the tennis finishes too. But unfortunately, the whole tennis career goes up in smoke when she suffers a devastating knee injury on the court. And that's when she decides to focus her attention on a couple of different players in her life. So she's actually friends and boyfriend with one of these guys, with Patrick Swayze, played by Josh O'Connor, and Art Donaldson, played by Mike Feist. Now, it's a story that doesn't tell that doesn't explain itself in a straight line, John. I mean, this film goes all over the place. But basically what we need to know is that these three tennis players meet when they're teenagers, right at the beginning of their careers. And then it all culminates in this small time challenger tour where Art, one of the guys, is actually married to Tashi. She is his coach. He's this world champion. He's on a bit of a losing streak. And to get back some of his confidence, because she clearly doesn't like that he's losing matches, he's kind of okay with it because he's at a point in his career where maybe he's hoping to retire. But she wants him to keep going. So she enrolls him in this small challenger tour to get his confidence back. And who does he come up against in that tour? Only Patrick, who's Tashi's ex-boyfriend, his old best friend. So Luca Guadagnino has a blast then explaining how we got there, what happened in all these relationships, who fell out with who ended up with who. It's a bit all over the place, but it makes sense when you watch it.
Okay. And just from the trailer, it's no real spoiler. Menage a trois, an amour faux of sorts may develop, right?
There's a little bit of that. You know, the actors, Josh O'Connor, Mike Faye, Zendaya, who is just terrific in this. They've been talking about that. They've said some interesting things on the red carpet and on the promo trail, which is that, you know, this is a film that is kind of all about sex, but doesn't really feature sex. And they're actually right. You know, there's an awful lot of... It is a very sexy film, and it's fueled by tension, and it's quite erotic in, at times. But there are no real R-rated scenes in this film. It's all very kind of innocent, and it's just more suggestive, and it's more about the things that we don't see. And, you know, at various points during the film, you know, the lads who are both involved in relationships with Zendaya's character, they're quite jealous of everything that's gone down, but Luca doesn't show us any of that. He just builds tension. He doesn't actually get to it. He doesn't actually get to the main drama, if you know what I mean, John. But but the performances here are just fantastic. Going into this, I was a little bit worried that when it comes to the tennis scenes, now, you know, with any sports film, there's always that thing where you can spot the seams. You can see the lines where we go from the actor to the stunt performer. But it was kind of it was encouraging to hear that, you know, Zendaya had worked with Brad Gilbert, the tennis player turned coach, for 3 months before filming, that Josh O'Connor and Mike Faye had put the hours in. And whatever way Luca has shot this, at times he shoots it almost like a music video. The tennis matches, although they are so over the top, they're brilliant to watch. And I just could not, if there are stand-ins for Josh O'Connor or Zendaya, I couldn't see them. So it's actually a pleasure to watch, you know, actors look as though they actually know what they're doing with the sport at the center of the film, because we don't often see that. Sometimes it's a bit messy.
Yeah. And you know, this kind of non-linear storytelling, which say we have an Annie Hall or 500 Days of Summer, or that can be great, but it can be really annoying if it's not done well. I'm sensing it's done very well in this, in terms of how it switches around time frames.
Yeah, put it this way, John, Luca tells the story better than I summed up the synopsis, because it is quite knotted, you know, a difficult film to talk about, but there's a rhythm there and there's a control there with Luca and his actors. They know what they're doing. The screenplay by Justin Kurtzkes, interestingly, Justin Kurtzkes is actually the husband of Celine Song, who wrote and directed Past Lives. And it's
that film.
Fantastic. Probably the best film of 2023.
Yeah, I'll go along with you.
As some critics have pointed out, it is interesting that she delivered a film about a love triangle, and then a few months later we're getting another film about a love triangle. So there is that interesting synergy there. His story may be a little bit knotted, but it always knows what it's doing, and Luca knows what he's doing. So despite the fact that we're going back and forward and sideways and every which way, but, you know, straight, there's always a confidence and a handle on it, and you're just like, okay, look, I'm just going to go along with this. Mm-hmm. And it helps too that the makeup and hair department are going above and beyond. I love the fact that the characters actually do look like teenagers when they're supposed to be teenagers, and then at the points in their career where they're in their early 30s, I don't know what they've done, because, you know, Zendaya is not in her 30s, but they actually do look as though they've reached that stage. So it's quite authentic to look at. There's an energy there that's unreal. There's a wonderful score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. It's just this electronic score that sometimes maybe is a little bit intrusive. You know, the characters might be talking to each other, and the next of all, boom, 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 and the music gets louder, the tension gets bigger, but it all added to the experience for me. I found myself at times kind of squirming in my seat, but in a good way. I know I said before that if a film makes me uncomfortable, I'll start getting a little bit twitchy, but this made me just, you know, excited. It's definitely one of the most exciting films that I've seen on the big screen in a long time.
Wow. And we are talking about Challengers, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 26th of April. But I do want to say about Zendaya, I interviewed her. I thought she was on the peak of a wave and continues to be. I thought she had such great presence and she's keeping her head. She's a brilliant actress, and I'm sensing she's brilliant in this. Like, you talk about the awkwardness and the cringiness of it. In one clip I saw, one of the tennis players says to her, "I love you." And she says, "I know." She just seems great. Is she? I mean, they're all good, but she's particularly good in this, from the little I've seen.
Oh yeah, no, she's incandescent here. I mean, she can steal a single scene with the look. And the film does revolve all around her. Sometimes you wonder, is this about Is this a film about three friends who made the mistake of becoming romantically involved? Is it a film about Art and Tashi's relationship? Or is it a film about the boys' relationship? Are they actually in love? There's an awful lot of things going on in there. And despite the fact that it's so busy in the plot department, Zendaya does this very effective thing of always bringing it back to her. I mean, that's nothing to say. That isn't to say that Josh and Mike aren't fantastic performers. There's just this movie star quality about Zendaya. Yeah. She walks into the room, there's no one else there. And it's been remarkable to watch her career, because I feel as though she did things the wrong way around. Wasn't she a child and a teenage actor? Yeah. And then she was on the American version of Dancing with the Stars, and now she's a movie star. You're not supposed to do it that way.
What I love about her is she seems to be just keeping her head. And you know, in a relationship with Tom Holland and all that it hasn't driven her crazy in any way. She just seems a delightful presence whenever you meet her. This sounds wonderful. What are you going to say stars-wise for Challengers?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought Luca, just as I said, there's a confidence there. He has a handle on everything. It's exhilarating. It's fabulous to look at. The match sequences are brilliant. The score is tremendous. Zendaya, just outstanding. I'm going to go with 5. I just had an absolute blast with this.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Sweet child of man. So 5. If you haven't done that. Well, you did it a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember what it was. But 5, you don't give them out often. So that good.
That good, yeah. I think we did it last with the Teacher's Lounge. It's been a good April.
Yeah, it certainly has. Okay, well, we better take a clip of Challengers.
Because you think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing. That's why you still have that serve.
It works.
Yeah, but you're not a tennis player. But you don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
It's a relationship.
Is that what you and Anna Miller had today?
It is, actually. For about 15 seconds there, we were actually playing tennis. And we understood each other completely. So did everyone watching. It was like we were in love.
That is a clip from Challengers, starring Zendaya. And it is in cinemas from this Friday, the 26th of April. Now, Chris, another movie which I have seen, The Land of Saints and Sinners. I'll be honest, part of me was slightly cringing going, a Netflix movie based kind of loosely in the Troubles in the 70s in Northern Ireland, starring Liam Neeson. No disrespect to Netflix and Liam Neeson, which I'm a big fan of both of them, but I did think this might have Paddy Wackery written all over it. I don't think it is. I think we just get by, don't we?
I think we do just get by. And I mean, it's not just that. It's the fact that the last few Liam Neeson films, they haven't really done anything for me at all. I thought his Philip Marlowe effort was a bit all over the place, although that might have been more Neil Jordan's fault. I thought the Retribution film he made, where he gets in his car and discovers there's a bomb under the sea, it was just, you know, speed, but without any ideas. But this took me by surprise. Now, I will say the first thing is that it is set in 1970s Northern Ireland, and it does obviously concern the Troubles. But if international audiences are expecting some sort of explanation for, you know, everything that went on during the Troubles, look elsewhere, because aside from the briefest of explanations at the beginning, where it says Northern Ireland 1974, after decades of civil unrest, armed conflict has broken out, Robert Lorenz, the filmmaker, Clint Eastwood's old protege, he's not interested in going and exploring the politics and everything involved there. It's just like, no, we're going to tell this thriller where the Troubles just kind of happened to, you know, where a group of IRA bombers just happened to cross paths with the anti-hero. So that anti-hero is Finbar Murphy, played by Liam Neeson. He's this geriatric hitman who all of a sudden has developed a bit of a guilty conscience. For decades, he's made a living as this trusted contract killer for a yappy Donegal crime boss. We have Colm Meaney there as Robert McHugh, very much enjoying himself in this Colm Meaney. And it's just, it's a miserable way of living, John. And I think he knows this. After years of killing, he just thinks, I want to do something else. And he had his reasons for getting into it. He returned from the war, broken man. His wife died. He turned to the drink, and it was actually Robert that gave him something to do, even if it was killing people. But now he wants to retire. He wants to develop his friendship with a neighbor, Rita, played by Niamh Cusack. He wants to be a gardener, but the retirement will have to wait, because as we see at the beginning, an IRA car bombing in Belfast has gone terribly wrong, and it actually claimed the lives of 3 children. So the group responsible for this attack, they've ventured up to Donegal to go into hiding, to lay low, to see if it all blows over. but it won't, because the various members in this group, they are loose cannons, and they cross paths with Finbar. They do something that he does not like, and he decides that although it's time to retire, it's also time for him to teach these guys some manners.
Yeah. And although, you know, you might be thinking, even Leon was popping into my head there, because maybe there are similar plot things as well, but this might start to, you know, take in territory and stuff like that. I don't think this is like that, in that the thing that I got was Liam Neeson, you feel he's not doing another Taken movie or another late blooming action hero that he's done for the last 10, 12 years. He's actually kind of invested in the role, I felt.
I think he is, yeah. He's doing some acting for a change. And you know, it suits him. You forget when he's playing the grey action hero for most of the last, 10, 15 years, that he is a great actor when he wants to be. And there is some good material here. You know, there's some good stuff about, you know, this, as I say, this hitman finally realizing that, you know, all of this, asking for the first time, what were all these killings for? And what am I doing with my life? And is there a way to redeem his soul? Because he has this conversation with the last person that he kills for Robert McHugh, where, you know, the person who's about to be shot has asked him, what are you happy with what you're doing? And what's all this been for? And it's as though he's never thought about it before. And Liam Neeson, during these very quiet, reflective moments, he is actually very good. And there's some lovely scenes in there too, with Sarah Green, with Neve Cusack. There's a terrific, friendship. You could make a buddy action thriller with Ciarán Hinds and Liam Neeson, who are old pals. And here you have Ciarán Hinds playing a local garda who we suspect doesn't quite believe Liam Neeson's character when he tells him that he just sells books. But despite the fact that they're on opposite sides of the law, they still have this lovely friendship. So there's a lot of stuff in here that you don't get from the contemporary, from other contemporary Liam Neeson actioners. Saying that, it is a bit ridiculous. It is a bit too straightforward at times. We have Kerry Condon there, who is, you know, I will always welcome Kerry Condon. I think she's a terrific performer, but she is... she's delightfully over the top. A lot of people are giving it socks in this film. You know, there's no subtlety in there whatsoever. It is a bit bumpy, but I was never bored. You know, it had me. I think it's the fact that there is that low bar when it comes to Neeson action films. That when a good one comes along, it's like even if it's just okay, I'll happily take that.
Yeah, I think I'm in complete agreement with you. I mean, I thought maybe where it goes in terms of who Liam Neeson's character is pitched against, it was kind of obvious. But I think there was a certain relief. This was Liam Neeson doing, you know, what he can do well when he puts his mind to it. And also, I was just so relieved this wasn't Northern Ireland trying to be explained to an international audience about what happened in the Troubles, because I don't think this is the place for that, you know. So I was kind of with you. It held my interest. Now, it might have been a sense of low expectations going into it, but it did absolutely hold my interest. So what would you say stars-wise for The Land of Saints and Sinners, streaming on Netflix again from this Friday, the 26th of April?
Yeah, as I said, it's a bit bumpy, but it's largely competent. It's nicely acted. Neeson's the best he's been in a long time. And also, it kind of fancies itself as a bit of a Western. And in a way, it sort of is. You know, quite formulaic. We've seen that setup before of that, you know, anti-hero trying to protect this small town from the horrors of the outside world. But it held me. It held my attention. Yeah. And that hour and 40-minute runtime, you know I like a short runtime, John. That was good too. So we'll go with 3 stars.
3 stars, yeah. I'm with you on that. So that is 3 stars for The Land of Saints and Sinners on Netflix, and a whopping 5 for Challengers, which is in cinemas also from this Friday. Chris Wasser, he just wants to be held. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there, giving reviews of In the Land of Saints and Sinners and Challengers. Up next, the gorgeous new movie, That They May Face the Rising Sun, and its director, Pat Collins. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, opening in cinemas this Friday, that's the 26th of April, is the exquisite That They May Face the Rising Sun, which is the film version of the acclaimed and indeed last novel of Jan McGahern. In it, we find Joe, played by Barry Ward, and Kate, played by Anna Burek, have returned to the Lakelands of Leitrim in a time that seems to be the late 70s or early 80s. Joe is a writer who grew up in the area, and she is an artist and gallery owner. Their house is very friendly with regular visitors from locals who bring their own share of life's baggage. There's the Shah, played by John Olahan, Bill, played by Brendan Conroy, a kind of subdued labourer who's condemned to a kind of slave-like life because he was illegitimate. There's the Livewire handyman Patrick, played brilliantly by Lawler Roddy, never short of a wry comment or philosophizing about his place in the grand scheme of things. And rounding it all out, our neighbors, Jamesy, played by Philip Dolan, and Mary, played by the great Ruth McCabe, who welcome, certainly at a time, Johnny home from England, played by Sean McGinley. There's drama in this movie, but it's also a slow paced movie, a lot like The Rhythm of the Lakeland Life. Some are comparing it to On Colleen Kewan, more of that later. It won the best film at last weekend's IFTAs. It was directed by legendary Irish filmmaker Pat Collins, who's made an incredible 30 movies plus in the last 20 years. Previous movies include things like Songs of Granite, which we previously spoke about in this show, and Silence. This is probably his most straight ahead dramatic movie so far. It's absolutely delightful. And I'm delighted to say, after 5 years of doing this show, I'm finally talking to Pat Collins. Pat, hello, how are you?
Thanks very much, John. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. So there's a very long intro. I've just looked at my clock. It was 2 minutes, but there's a lot to you, Pat.
Yeah.
Tell me this. I mentioned to you before we came on air, and I don't say this as, I'm so literary, because I'm not really, but I did read that They May Face the Rising Sun not long after it came out, because it was kind of very popular at the time, and it would turn out to be John McGahan's last film, or last book, I should say. But you know, I didn't think at the time, wow, this is a movie. And I've heard you kind of previously say there might even have been something unfilmable about the book. So it's such an obvious place to start. But why did you want to make this?
Yeah, I mean, it was, first of all, it was my favorite of McGahan's books. And I made a documentary on John about 2 years before he passed away. In 2005, it went out on RTE called John McGahan, A Private World. And I suppose it was very close to the world that I grew up in and lived in, and I think it was just something about the characters that lived around the lake. They were very distinct kind of personalities and very distinct people, and they're very close to the people that I grew up around. And I think that these characters exist in every townland, and I don't even think that they're exclusively Irish. I think they're actually, you know, I've travelled with the film now in Sweden and America and in Italy, and people there are saying, oh, they're exactly like the characters that live in the countryside there as well, which is kind of, I wasn't really expecting. And but I suppose for me, I thought maybe, you know, that these kind of people in a way were overlooked, I think, by in Ireland. They were kind of, I think there was often a kind of a, you know, the small farms and all that, you're kind of encouraged, all the young people are kind of encouraged to get away from them, you know, from the farms and go to the cities. And I kind of always felt, you know, that these people in a way didn't get their enough attention for how kind of interesting and complex they were, you know. And that's what I think about John's book. I think it kind of gives them a kind of a dignity or something. And I wanted to portray that.
Yeah. And what I really like about it is there's no hint of stage Irishness about it. Do you know what I mean? These people have small lives, but yet some of their baggage that I refer to, or their trauma, are huge and universal, be it the Italian hillsides or the Irish lakelands. Like, are you conscious when you're making a movie like this that, you know, it's Leitrim in the 80s or the 70s or wherever you want to say it is, that you don't have kind of pigs in the kitchen, even though some of these scenes do take place in Joe's kitchen?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I kind of saw that Joe and Kate's kitchen is almost like a kind of a stage that different characters enter and exit, and they come in and they tell their stories to Joe and Kate, and sometimes looking for help or advice, and sometimes just passing the time, you know, or doing work. So, I mean, that's the real difficulty with material like this, I think, and that's where the casting comes in. You know, if you had an American actor playing Patrick, or an American actor playing Jamesy, it just would not work. It couldn't possibly work, really. I mean, it's not, and I think, you know, you kind of, a lot of filmmakers, I suppose, they're kind of under pressure to make their films more commercial, and to make big, you know, talk, the talk is casting up, you know what I mean? And we were very determined not to do that. I think I learned a huge amount kind of working with those actors. You know, there was LaShawn McGinley, Lotta Roddy. I mean, they're bringing a wealth of experience, life experience and theatre experience and great readers, you know, and great intelligence. And I think you couldn't get what they gave, you know, from people who didn't understand the characters or understand where they were coming from. And I think same with Barry Ward as well, actually. I mean, Barry's very understated, but I think his performance, every time I see it, it gets better and better for me. He's just so kind of, he's the center of it, really, even though it's very, very quiet, you know?
Yeah, the casting is brilliant in it. And like I was, because there isn't a bum note in it, to use an American phrase, right? But particularly Laura Roddy, he's a philosopher, yet he's a handyman who wants to build this kind of shed-like structure in Joe's garden. He's absolutely brilliant. And Patrick McGinley, and I know we could talk about all the cast, but by golly, he's brilliant in it, because I didn't know what kind of character he was for a lot of the movie. And I think that's brilliant in it, because he's this guy who's returning from Ford's factory. And then he goes back, and not to give spoilers or whatever, but it's hard nearly to get a handle on him. So all this isn't a question, but all I'm saying to you is I salute the casting wholeheartedly, because it's absolutely brilliant. And as you rightly say, you know, this film is unimaginable, like the people in it, and it's just brilliant in that regard. But can I just go back to Joe in the kitchen? Because, you know, I mentioned baggage and trauma in this movie, and all movies that have any kind of drama in them have to have some of that. But at the same time, there is a lot of joy in this film, and it's in the simple celebration of, I suppose, neighbours and neighbours gathering. Or is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, like, we knew there was kind of very subtle humor in it, but when it screened in London, actually, the second screening in the London Film Festival, everybody was laughing so much. I actually turned to Sharon, my wife, and I said, "Geez, I didn't realize we'd made a comedy." You know, it was kind of so it was so much laughter, and that varies from screening to screening. Sometimes, people are laughing at it depends on the mood in the room, really. But there's lots of subtle humor in it. And I think even Patrick, even though he's very cruel and some of the things he says are very cruel, he's very charismatic and you're kind of drawn to him, you know. And so that there's, I think it's important to reflect the reality of that complexity. You know, there was complex as anybody, you know, those, like, you know, that character Patrick, I think he's loosely based on a character that lived around John and Madeline in Leitrim. And he was a character who was a loved acting, but he was a tradesman, had great intelligence, used to bring books up to John and Madeline and used to read passages from the books out loud to them, you know. And but if you were to look at him from outside, you'd say, oh, he's just this tradesman. But he had this hidden kind of talent and hidden intelligence that never really got an outlet, you know. And I suppose the countryside is full of those, really, I think, full of those kind of people. And it's a balance of goodness and darkness. And I think James is kind of all good and Patrick brings a bit of darkness. But even said that, even James is good, but he still doesn't offer his brother a home, you know what I mean, when he's come back from England. So, but that's the kind of, like a lot of people said to me, well, like, why wouldn't they give him, you know, why wouldn't they take him in? But there's, you know, that's not too many people nowadays would take in their, you know, their elderly brother, you know, at 70 years of age, you know, and let them live out their days and with their own family, you know. It's not really done much, you know.
Yeah, and I hadn't mentioned that in the movie, but there is this whole thing about him and returning home and if Jamesy will take him in, and that seems so familiar. And I could imagine why audiences in Italy or England are responding to that, because, you know, we all have families and we all have problems in those families. Listen, I mentioned in the start on Colleen Kewan, and I hope that doesn't piss you off, but I said that on purpose because I want people to think, and listen, you don't need me to promote your film for you, but I think it's a very good analogy, because the reason I think why people responded to, or a very good comparison on Colleen Kewan is because it, and why I loved it was almost art house movie making, and yet it told this beautiful story that everyone could respond to, people who know nothing about camera angles or anything like that. And it was paced slowly, but yet it wasn't boring, if that's not too crude a way to put it. And I think your film is exactly the same. And I'm all about getting people into the cinema to watch movies that they mightn't traditionally watch. So are you okay with the comparison that people are making? Because I think it might help people go and see this.
I mean, yeah, there was a kind of it was a movie. I think David Putnam saw the film actually, and he said to me, he said, you know, it's going to have to be sold as, you know, this year's Colleen Kuhn. And I everybody wants to be unique, and everybody wants to make their own films. And if anything that gets people to the cinema is great. And I really think that people will enjoy it in the cinema. I don't think it'll work in television. It'll work, you know, at home. But I think people could really use the opportunity to kind of go to the cinema and bring their parents or bring their neighbors to it, because I think there's a hell of a lot of people, you know, I think there's something like 400,000 dodgy boxes or whatever they're called, you know, those memory keys in the country. and people are watching movies, you know, illegally downloaded, and it's not the same thing as going to the cinema. So
no,
I think Colleen Kuhn, I think, you know, was probably has influenced by kind of world cinema, and I feel like that I'm bringing kind of world cinema to an Irish story as well, you know what I mean? I think I very much look to kind of world cinema as a kind of an influence, I suppose, you know, and certain directors and all that. So and I think anything that brings that kind of sensibility is good, you know, rather than always looking to, even though I love American cinema, I think that sometimes it's great to bring what's distinctive about ourselves, you know, and making place is important. If you think of Americans, you know, they have no problem with sense of place. You know what I mean? They make their films in Los Angeles or New York, and place is important to them. And sometimes, and I'm not criticizing really, but I think that's should be true of Ireland as well. You stay true to the place, and then it's going to have a much better chance of actually resonating with people, rather than trying to make Ireland look like somewhere, like a nowhere, you know?
Yeah. Well said. Well, listen, in closing then, like I could talk to you for hours, but just finally, you know, you've done so many movies and, you know, to the point that you've had mid-career, you know, showings of your movie, retrospectives in the IFI and places like that. You've been doing this for a long time. But, and I mean this with the greatest degree of respect, you have a loyal audience. It's, I don't want to say small, but it's cultish is the wrong word. What I'm trying to say rather haphazardly is niche, maybe, if that's not a criticism, but this is going to bring you to a much bigger audience, I suggest. Are you getting a sense of that? And like, you're a human being who has an ego and a desire for the work to be seen just like anyone else. Are you okay with that? Because I think this is going to, not that you need me to use phrases like take you to the next level, but this is going to get a wider audience, I think, than anything else you've ever done before.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can feel it on the street, like even down at home, you know, it's in West Cork, you know, I've more people are aware of it than some of my more obscure documentaries or whatever. So, I mean, but I am okay with it, because I'm kind of maybe all about the work, in the sense that I kind of, you know, I've made a couple of documentaries since that. I'm writing another feature film again. And I kind of, anything that makes it easier to get funding for the next film, and that's the way I think of it, really. You know, there probably isn't any financial rewards. But if that came, I'd be very happy with that too, you know.
Yes. We're not communists, as Marlon Brando said in The Godfather. Well, listen, I will be doing my bit here to get people to go and watch that They May Face the Rising Sun. It's absolutely beautiful. I haven't even mentioned the gorgeous cinematography and how beautiful it looks, but I think that might be a given with your movies. It was directed by the legendary, whether he wants me to call him that or not, Pat Collins. Pat, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, John.
The days were quiet.
They're still here. Never thought they'd last.
Through them ran the sense like an underground river.
And will he never have children?
Maybe there's enough people in the world, Patrick.
That there would come a time when these days would be looked back on as happiness. All that life could give of contentment and peace.
They're happy, lad. Is that what you're saying?
So what more can you ask for?
I'm moving on.
What will happen to the gallery?
We can only keep it in the family, as it were, if you come back and take over.
It still feels like we just live here day to day.
But isn't that the beauty of it?
You wouldn't leave me, Joel. You wouldn't forget me.
A clip there from That Day May Face the Rising Sun from director Pat Collins. And was obvious from everything I've said thus far in the show. It is a gorgeous film. It really is. And I hope it travels far and wide because it deserves it in cinemas and not on dodgy boxes, as Pat Collins very humorously said. Yeah, so a gorgeous film. Up next, comedian Anne Gill D on her favourite film. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted to join now by comedian Anne Gill D, who's a founding member and writer and performer with the critically acclaimed Irish musical comedy trio The Nulas. Her latest solo show is the intriguingly titled How to Get the Menopause and Enjoying It, which has been playing to rave reviews. I'm delighted to say she joins me now to chat about her favourite movie. Hi Anne, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. So listen, you'll be interested to hear, when it comes to favourite movies, we've banned a few. We had to ban The Shawshank Redemption and we had to ban Back to the Future and Some Like It Hot. And your movie is getting close to being banned, but hasn't been yet because it's been chosen so much, particularly by comedians, which you'll be pleased to hear. So will you tell our listeners what your favourite movie is and why?
My favourite movie of all time is With Neil and I. Why? Absolutely brilliant characters, the most memorable lines ever. And the whole thing is, it's not a comedy, it's a tragedy with hilarity going through the whole piece.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it. It's not pitching itself out as a comedy. And the characters are so complex and it's so funny.
And just remind people, particularly like younger audiences, what it's about. It's kind of two struggling actors, one of whom is famously Richard E. Grant.
Yeah, it's two struggling actors and it's about the end of an era. It's about the end of the 60s and it's about them growing up. Actually, I just saw this brilliant documentary of Bruce Robinson who wrote it, and it's kind of semi-autobiographical because that was him in the mid-60s. He was a struggling actor in a big house. And he said, it's like at that point where you're all broke, you're all starving, you're all aspiring, and you're all knowing that it might not work out in your life because you're just at that age. They're in their late 20s, hitting their 30s, they're realizing that some people are getting the break, some people are not, they're struggling along. It's also the end of the hippie era. And so they're absolutely destitute. There's just so many brilliant scenes about their destitution and how grim their lives have become.
Yeah.
One scene where Paul McGann is the kitchen is so disgusting. He has to make coffee in a bowl and he's drinking his coffee with a soup spoon. And then Richard goes, "There's soup. Why didn't I get any soup?" And then there's Danny who comes along, who's a drug dealer. And there's just all these grim characters. And then they decide that they will go to Uncle Monty and go to his house in the country to get a breakaway from the absolute grimness of their life. And then it transpires that that basically the way that Richard E. Grant encourages, with Neil, encourages his uncle to give them the house in the country is that he promises Paul McGann to him when Monty is going, I mean to have you, even if it's burglary. But the beautiful thing about it is you have all these damaged characters and you just love them all. And so they go to the country and you're expecting it to be a beautiful country house. And of course, it's a broken down shack and they go through all the indignities of trying to survive that. And they meet these hilarious characters like the farmer. You know, Richard E. Grant is going, he can't believe how unhelpful the country people are. They've no money, they've no food, and they're freezing. And he said, he expected the country people to be more helpful. And he was going, I thought they'd be all out the back discussing butter. then they go to this farmer's house, and the wife says, you know, oh, he's up in the top field. You know, if you're looking for my husband for fuel, he's up in the top field. You'll recognize him. His leg is wrapped in polythene. And then there's the poacher who gives him the hare. It's absolutely outrageous, and it just captures a certain moment in the life of aspiring artistic young people going into adulthood, and at the end of that era in England, the end of the hippie era. And so it's elegiac, and it's and the characters are all damaged in one way or another, and it's very moving as well as hilarious. I find it very moving. I love the scene at the end where it's a brilliant truth about being an actor. Another reason I love it is I discovered it when I was at drama college in London. I went to a college called ALRA in Wandsworth, and it was in 1991, so it had been out for a few years, and it wasn't a hit to begin with. And it was somebody in my course who said, we're just telling everybody you have to see this film, because it really mirrored what was going to be our experience. Because, you know, you get into drama college and you're totally involved in it all, and you've huge aspirations, and you can also fully see the way the career pans out for most people. It's a real struggle. And so it's just really, it really personally resonated with me. And also the London I lived in then is really quite similar in some elements to what I see in the film.
The scene where he's in the zoo and he does Hamlet, it brings such a poignancy to it, because you're like, this guy's actually a great actor, his character in the movie.
That is the whole thing. Like, it was one thing I realised in drama college, how hard it is to do Shakespeare well. Of course, it's written in iambic pentameter, the verses, which is supposed to mirror natural speech. And that he just blew me away when I saw him do that speech, because he captures that. Some people just declaim it so much and it loses all its essence, but he captures exactly the human modulation of the words that he wrote. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost my mirth. Every time I see, I watched it again last night before doing this interview. I just,
well, thank you for that.
I burst into tears at that final thing, because he's so funny through it all. He's the funniest lines, like, you know, when they're in the cream tea shop down the country and he's going, we'll have the finest wines known to humanity and we'll have them here now. He's just so hilarious through it all. And yet at that moment, you see that he knows he's going to be an also ran in his career, that it's not, he is not going to get the break. You see the damaged child.
Yeah.
He is. This is the wonderful complexity of his character. He is such a user and abuser and so awful and so charming, and you just love him. And somebody was telling me once that approaching the character, he just had this mantra in his head for every line he said. In his head, he was going, how dare you? How dare you? And that was the underlying thing. And I love the truth of the moment when Paul McGann, who's the I in the piece, gets the telegram saying that he's got the part, and then he gets a letter saying that he actually has the lead part in the play in Manchester, so he's leaving. The look on Richard E. Grant's face is, oh my God, it captures so many things any performer will know. When you've got good news and maybe someone isn't actually 100% happy for you.
Yes.
His look is perfection. It is so complex. It's he's going, well done, and you can just see he's just crumbling inside, and the complexity of negative emotion going on and coming through him. Another thing I love about the film, I wanted to say, I was thinking about this because I was reading some person talking about film and saying, oh, it's such a visual medium, I don't care about the script, it's the visual. I realized watching it that what I love in a film is really brilliant, complex characters and the camera on the people, and really seeing how nuanced human beings are and the subtlety of the way people interact. And this, That film, it, you know, is such a superior film to almost anything that's ever been made. It's absolutely, it's so brilliant.
Well, you clearly love that film, and thank you for rewatching it. And as I say, it's chosen regularly by comedians and performers, so it seems to me it's the comedian's movie. And talking of actors and comedians, your show, brilliant title, How to Get the Menopause and Enjoy It, which you've been touring now for a couple of years, and I know people can see in the Civic Theatre in Tala on the 29th of June. I know it's hard to summarise a show in a few lines, but my understanding is it's obviously about the menopause, but it's also a bit about maybe, you know, surviving life's vicissitudes as well and laughing through them or something along those lines.
That's totally what it is. Actually, my partner, Paul, who I work with on the show, who came up with the title, as he always says, behind every great woman is a fair to middling man. It was him who came up with the title. And the title is framing the theme, which is about midlife. So I just bounce it off all the complexities of menopause, and I frame menopause as reverse puberty, and I ask women to think about when their puberty kicked in and all these hormones started, and just remembering back to then and thinking we're at the other end of that now. So there's a kind of this arc, and so there's a lot of evoking of what life was like growing up in Ireland in the 70s and 80s, and as well as a lot of information, a lot of shared stuff, and the guys that come along absolutely love it, because it is a very inclusive condition, John. You know, you don't have to get the menopause to suffer from it. So.
Very well said. So listen, if people want to know more about that, angildee.com. And also, you've a brand new comedy show starting in the end of August. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. It's a work in progress that I'm presenting in the Viking Theatre the last week of August. I've been writing that. I write extremely slowly. I've been working on that for a year and a half, and I have to get it out onto stage and start testing it. But that's going to be brilliant.
Wonderful. Well, listen, her favourite movie is unquestionably With Neil and I, her very well-received show, How to Get the Menopause and Enjoy It, will be coming to the Civic Theatre in Tala on June the 29th. For more dates, angildee.com. Anne, thank you very much.
John, thank you. Thank you for asking me to do this, because it forced me to watch it again, and I loved it as if I'd seen it for the first time, and I've seen it about 10 times.
The pleasure was ours.
What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god! The beauty of the world, pagan of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. No, nor women neither. No women neither.
Richard E. Grant there from With Neil and I in full Shakespeare mode. Now, I have played that clip before, but it was Anne's favourite scene from the movie, and possibly mine too, because he's just brilliant in it. And even though there's huge humour in that movie, there's also a lot of tragedy and sadness, and that speech carries all of that brilliantly. That movie has been chosen many times, but it's not on the banned list yet. It hasn't quite reached peak chosingness, if that's even a word, and it isn't, but you know what I mean. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne Gildee for choosing her favourite movie, With Neil and I. If you want to get in touch at any stage during the week, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I will just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. You can listen back to any of our items on the Newstalk app, and you will hear all sorts of interviews with everyone choosing their favourite movies, from Ken Doherty to John Banville, to interviews with Amy Adams and Glenn Close and George Clooney and Julia Roberts. So if you are a movie buff and a TV buff, or even interested in those things, and you're new to this show, there is 5 years of pretty interesting stuff, dare I say it, that you can listen back to if you're looking for something out on your walk or your run, or whatever it is you do to pass the time. I'm starting to waffle, so I better go. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and have a safe week ahead.